Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast with Trent and Leighton Kling. Coming up on the first Retail Focus of November, we're talking retail sporting goods. Also, we'll discuss Retail Properties of America, which is a well-known retail REIT, a warehouse club innovation. That'll lead our show. We'll talk Lumber Liquidators again, and we'll preview Mall of America, and we'll talk one more time about Toys R Us in the looking ahead portion of today's episode. Please follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Retail Podcast. A big thanks to those who have subscribed on whatever platform you do use. Every subscription matters to us. And to that end, in fact, if you have a product or service you'd like to promote, we actually have some advertising availabilities coming up for the first time in a while. So feel free to shoot us an email at retailpodcast@gmail.com. Well, we lead today's show with Walmart's introduction of a new innovation by the way of Sam's Club down in Texas. Now, Sam's Club has consistently posted positive comps and has been at the forefront of the omnichannel push for wholesale clubs over the last year or two, despite not having what is the superior in-store service from Costco. But Sam's Club here has gone all in with some departmental restructuring and building out their omnichannel infrastructure in the past year. They have a new CEO now in John Furner. In January, we covered a story that impacted retail media for weeks as Sam's Club decided to abruptly close 63 stores in the U.S. in territories that covered 24 states and Puerto Rico. Some of these locations remain closed. There's actually one nearby me that is closed and does not serve as an e-commerce distribution hub, but others do serve as an e-commerce distribution hub. And Leighton, I know when we talked about this story early on in the week, you were excited because A, it's very much in that warehouse club space that you enjoy, but B, you think this is a potential game changer for Sam's Club with a few tweaks.
There definitely have been a lot of changes happening at Walmart, Walmart corporate. And over the past few months, we've really talked about how Walmart is restructuring how they view retail and how they're going to be highlighting different technology initiatives throughout all of their stores. And this really does relate to Sam's Club, as Trent mentioned. They've been investing heavily over the past few months, the past few years in their omnichannel network, really trying to boost up how they're perceived by the public. And this really does highlight some of the operational changes that they've made and how the company is aggressively experimenting with new ideas that give credence to the idea that the older retailer can pull off some new tricks. And in June, Sam's Club announced plans to open a smaller pilot store in Dallas that would be tech heavy, but few details were given at that time. And now we have a lot more details and are able to take a small peek inside thanks to a few photos from media and see really how this limited member opening is going to look for those first few customers that are going to be invited into this Dallas store. And as a relevant side note, Sam's did close four stores in Texas earlier this year with those 63 closings that Trent had talked about, but none in Dallas. Three were in the Houston area and one in San Antonio, Texas. It seems like many pilot concepts have been coming by the way of Texas as of late for a variety of retailers we've talked about on the podcast. Sam's Club has not shied away from innovations in the Midwest or the Southern markets in the past decade. You see a lot of other retailers not really experimenting in Texas, the state of Texas, but more on the East Coast or West Coast if they were to invest in a new pilot concept. But it seems as though many pilot concepts have been headed to Texas because it's sort of a tech hotbed with a growing engineering base through Austin and the Dallas areas. But many years ago, Sam's Club experimented with an RFID point of sale system in Oklahoma for a club there. It was a conventional Sam's Club around 125,000 square feet that was designed to be one of the first waves of cashierless technology that they were to use at scale. But you know what, Trent? It was not reliable and they had to abandon it after a few years. And this was after they invested, by the way, heavily in other Sam's Clubs with that technology infrastructure, thinking that they were going to actually pull that off. It did not work. So a lot of money spent, millions of dollars spent, in fact, and it just did not come to fruition. Now they think they have the right technology to have a cashierless store. And Dallas, according to management, was chosen as a prime market for this technology-based store. And it's in proximity to their headquarters in Bentonville, Arkansas as well, which gives executives a chance to actually go between the two cities without having to log that many miles, around 350 miles between the two cities. So again, not that far. The store will be different from a conventional Sam's Club, as I mentioned, in a variety of ways. Most clubs are over 120,000 square feet in size, and most have around 210 employees that are made up of a full-time, part-time mix. But this store will have around 32,000 square feet and roughly 46 employees. The reduction in employee base is largely due to needing less front-end personnel because, again, they're not going to have cashiers checking you out in this store. The store will need no cashiers and, as a result, no supervision for those hourly workers. Our assumption is that the people will be in charge of the systems, making sure that the scan and go process is in working order. So there will be a few supervisors on the front end. We can compare this to the people needed to supervise self-checkout at Kroger or Walmart, how they operate now through those self-checkout lines. And if you look at a statement from their newer CEO, John Furner, he said that eliminating friction doesn't mean replacing exceptional member service with digital experience, basically saying that he knows that their members expect both human personnel and fast throughput. So they want the technology to aid their shopping experience, but if they have a hard time finding somebody, if they have a hard time navigating that new technology, human beings will actually be there to help escort those people through the store and make them have a good, positive experience in the Sam's Club Now concept.
And let's face it, there are going to be technological glitches, but more importantly, there are going to be people that will need help with the app or that built-in map that Leighton mentioned, and that's where these employees come in. We think ultimately, long-term, this concept, the Sam's Club Now concept, will require more than 40 employees to conduct business at the store, in part because there is going to be that sharp learning curve for customers. Now, customers using this location, because they know what it is, because it's branded separately as Sam's Club Now, they're obviously going to be the more tech-savvy customers, but there will still be problems that need to be addressed, as Leighton talked about, and as John Furner kind of addressed in this press release that Walmart sent out. Now, the map that we talked about is supposed to keep real-time tracking of items throughout the store. It's an interactive map. There are 400 cameras that are lined out around the store, and customers will have the option of actually creating a list of items ahead of time that they want before actually showing up and gathering those items. And the app, in theory, should create the best store route. This would be a complete 180 to those old school ideas that highlighted a customer's desire to meander around and spot deals they didn't initially intend to buy. Things like zip strips and end caps, such a big idea for the first iteration of Sam's Club, but the Sam's Club Now, not so much attuned to some of those impulse buys. Don't know how this will affect the samples, though. It's a question that a lot of people had online about this, but it doesn't mean that impulse buys won't be pushed out to the consumer in some way, shape, or form, because one Amazon-like feature that will be inherent to the app and included in the app will be predictive content that will suggest complementary goods or historical purchases for the member. Now, anytime you cut down square footage, that means, of course, that you're going to also be cutting down the amount of product that's in the store. And Sam's Club, like Costco and BJ's Wholesale, has recently grown their assortment of grocery items over the last two decades, and as a result, they're now seeing how all grocery categories, including fresh and frozen, are making up a larger percentage of store revenue. With this, management recognizes that both business members at Sam's Club, after all, they went through that small business marketing phase a while back, and regular families with a Sam's Club membership head to the stores less and less for that treasure hunt experience, but more for habitual consumption. So seasonal one-time buys sometimes take over the center of the store. That may not be the case now with this new Sam's Club Now location, as they're mostly going to feature groceries. And while Costco has many one-time buys that they feature prominently month to month, Sam's Club hasn't really given it their all in that space. That's not the space that Sam's Club wants to occupy. Again, I mentioned their small business push. Part of that being that, hey, you can come to Sam's Club, find the goods that will make your small business tick. We're in business for small business, went the tagline. With this new Sam's Club Now location, they're basically pulling out the headlines and some of these center sections of the store. And Leighton, I know you're very familiar with the merchandise club setup. How will this affect the way things are merchandised within the store?
Yeah, I think looking at the pictures, it's going to be a little bit more compact than a normal Sam's Club. So the aisles are going to be a little less wide. They're going to be a little narrower. And honestly, you're going to see a lot less promotional items. You're going to see less pods throughout the store. And I think you're going to see less services as well. So a lot of people think of Sam's Club as the one-stop shop for cake decorating, having fresh baked goods. I think a lot of that selection is going to dwindle down. And I think you're going to get a lot less personalization, but a lot more types of items that are ready-to-eat meals. In fact, Sam's Club had noted that they're going to have smaller items, so items that aren't necessarily going to be your conventional bulk items, where, for instance, if you get a pack of Ziploc bags, you're not going to get 6,000 of them. You might just get a normal amount that you, let's say, would normally get at a Kroger location or a Walmart Supercenter. The grocery SKUs may largely resemble what Sam's Club already brings to the table as far as their grocery selection, but management has identified, like I said, some smaller items that you wouldn't normally see. But curious to see exactly what those items are. While we're given those details, we don't exactly know what products are going to be affected in terms of offering smaller sizes. And looking at the pictures that have come out again, the store has lower ceilings as well, so it's a more intimate setting. So not only is the square footage a little smaller, the entire concept is a little bit smaller. And this is something that Trent and I questioned. Why wouldn't they just rebrand it altogether? And we understand that some of the items that are going to be in this store are going to be the same exact items, the same UPCs, the same SKUs as a conventional Sam's Club. However, I think this concept is going to be positive for them. Why not rebrand it? Call it something entirely different. Stray away from the Sam's Club brand. It's sort of perhaps viewed as a stale brand, if you will. Just simply putting "now" at the end of Sam's Club may not do it for a lot of people. People are going to be curious about this because it is a smaller concept and some of the branding and signage is different, but I would have liked to see a little more thinking outside the box in order to differentiate from the other wholesale clubs. The store, by the way, will officially open on an invite basis, as I had mentioned earlier, to local members for testing as soon as next week, or this upcoming week, in fact. The grand opening to the general public is tentatively scheduled for a couple weeks from now. Very curious to see the public reception of this. Again, I think it's going to be an overall positive for Sam's Club, for Walmart Incorporated, but I think time will tell and to really see what they modify and what they do to make this a more customer-friendly concept. And again, I would like to see maybe them trying some old conventional things out within the store. For instance, having maybe one or two normal checkouts just in case that technology does glitch or in fact somebody does not have their smartphone on them, forgot it at home, and cannot use that Scan and Go app. Hibbett Sports makes a move to acquire a smaller footwear retailer. And Hibbett Sports, not a company we talk about too often, but they are publicly traded. They're fighting to stay relevant in an increasingly amalgamated space. And Hibbett has been around since 1945, has done well, but over the past few years, you can see that they are struggling in terms of top-line sales. It's one of the oldest sporting goods retailers still doing business in the brick-and-mortar space. They have over 1,000 stores in the United States and mostly smaller cities and towns throughout the United States. So that is the one key differentiation. While e-commerce is growing, a lot of people in smaller towns and cities, they don't shop online and they don't have a big box store to go to. So Hibbett Sports really has found their niche. But again, as a publicly traded company, has had ups and downs, especially over the past year in the stock market. Their second quarter caused investors to worry as they had yet another large loss, one that tallied up to 6 cents per share on the earnings per share front. The positives for us from that front were the same store sales increases of 4.1% and an e-commerce sales boost, while not that large, not in the double digit territory, but it still brought them an 8% gain there and as they continue to make strides in their once antiquated website.
So 2 days prior to the anticipated third quarter release date, Hibbett Sports actually announced that they had plans to buy City Gear. So no earnings release to talk about yet, but City Gear is a privately owned athletic footwear retailer with 135 stores in 15 states. And athletic footwear makes up a huge part of what Hibbett Sports has to offer. And in fact, footwear in a Hibbett Sports store will take up about 20 to 25% of the square footage, depending on the location. Hibbett will pay $88 million in cash and has offered operating incentives if the deal hits positive benchmarks in the next 2 years. $25 million is at stake in regards to their short to midterm performance here. Before debt financing assumptions, this is likely to make a sizable dent in Hibbett's balance sheet, as they had just around $119 million in cash and cash equivalents at the end of the last quarter. But let's look at this inclusion a little bit more deeply. City Gear, who also has a strong e-commerce site, one could argue a stronger one than Hibbett, at citygear.com, will actually not be rebranding. This is something that Hibbett's done in the past with certain acquisitions, although others, like for example their acquisition of Sports Editions, those actually ended up rebranding long term. But executives at Hibbett feel like City Gear, already known for their service quality, and as a result won't be changing much. Also, it would be difficult to integrate the square footprint of City Gear into that traditional Hibbett branding, where Hibbett stores are typically larger in terms of square footage than the City Gear stores. Executives at City Gear will also stay on, thus giving some in the executive suite who have an ownership stake a bit of a double boost there, because they'll stay employed, also stand to benefit from this deal. Salaries and compensation plans from earned income at Hibbett plus part of that $25 million if City Gear stays on track with their financial targets. What City Gear does bring to the table is that distinct focus on the most popular shoe brands and a very popular category for Hibbett in footwear. Athletic shoes are City Gear's primary focus, as we said, but they also have popularized extensions in terms of everyday use shoes from a number of brands like Reebok, Puma, Nike, and New Balance, among others. Now, many of those brands make primarily athletic shoes, but they've been beginning to put out more stylistic shoes. Anyone who's followed Nike or Under Armour or Adidas over the last 3 years knows exactly what we're talking about here, with those everyday use shoes contrasting from the athletic shoes that are specifically coming out. Now, City Gear's apparel is a bit mixed as well, with male and female sections that aren't solely focused on the sports aspect. You see a lot more athleisure there, but also True Religion is a brand that is a prime example in terms of their apparel, as their high fashion shirts are featured prominently on City Gear's website. The term lifestyle apparel really does come to mind when you look at City Gear's product selection. So a different component they bring to the table from the predominantly athletically focused Hibbett Sports. And that's exactly why Hibbett wants to fold in City Gear here, is just for that expertise that they gained. And City Gear comes by it honestly.
I couldn't really say it any better, Trent, because this is what it's about, right? It's more about the intellectual property, the knowledge base, the know-how from a company that's been in the industry for quite some time. And having been founded in 1978, they really know a lot about what the industry has gone through and how the changes have affected the everyday consumer. And one could argue that one of the things that Hibbett is buying, besides the customer base and inventory, is the know-how. And perhaps some are arguing that that is the primary reason they're spending so much money for this City Gear acquisition. And when one thinks of throwback apparel and one-time runs of Jordans, one automatically thinks of social media and social media influencers. Instagram and Facebook have been single-handedly changing how supply chain dynamics work in the footwear industry. And now wholesalers wait for something to take prominence or become viral before pushing it out to retailers. Whereas before, shoe brands would just really hope for the best and push out whatever comes to mind, push out what their creative directors have in store, and hope that that inventory sells through. But inevitably, if it does not, you have to cut margins, and that's where the profits fall through. And I think that City Gear has their finger on the pulse of the urban customer base. And you can really see this in their mission statement. They say that we know our customer. We know what's trending. We know what's popular. And to be honest, Trent, that is vital for this industry. If you don't have that, you no longer have much of a business at all. You can no longer just buy random shoes and hope for the best in terms of pushing through that inventory and getting that inventory turn up. Brick and mortar and e-commerce are predicated upon having known what your customer wants in this particular category. And from what we can gather, their sales methodology really does center around what's cool and trending versus just being there for the customer, seeing if they want to try on a particular shoe, seeing if the shoe fits according to the customer size. That basic customer service methodology no longer works in the footwear industry. You think back to Payless Shoes and why maybe they're having some issues with City Gear, they've evolved. They've gotten with the times, and you can really see that they have a robust training program for their associates, and they're always looking to change and be fundamentally better for their consumer base. And undoubtedly, Hibbett will actually use this knowledge to carry a varied product selection of their own and really try to influence their current customer and to try to make sure that they're educated on a larger assortment that's a little more trendy. And another thing that struck us about this City Gear acquisition is that they delve much deeper into the various brands than they carry than others. While some footwear retailers just put out what brands they carry, what basic brands they carry, and what you can expect at a given store, they go much further, Trent. They, in our opinion, go where a lot of others don't. And we're not talking in terms of superior visual merchandising that you get from other e-commerce websites, but they offer an extensive history of what these brands created and what they're most well known for in terms of the gear that's on the market today. So for instance, Trent had mentioned how they have some True Religion apparel on their website. They actually have more space dedicated to the True Religion backstory than they do the products themselves. So I think this is extremely important. They understand the brand and they understand that some customers, regardless of the quality of the apparel or regardless of the quality of the shoes that they're putting on, really care about the brand. And if you can promote that brand story, that is very important to some individuals. And perhaps the biggest irony in this deal, if you could call it an irony, is the fact that City Gear has been growing organically since the 1980s, but turned to acquiring some other small chains as recently as 7 years ago to gain their own product knowledge. They're not complacent. This really speaks to how they're always looking to learn and grow at the executive level. Three different companies they've acquired within a short amount of time, totaling 33 stores in Missouri, Georgia, Indiana, and Ohio. Their popularity has been aided with endorsements from the NBA, with teams in the South and Midwest, including the very popular Houston Rockets. This brand recognition has really helped them grow in the West into markets where Hibbett Sports traditionally has done business for a number of years.
We're kind of dancing around the main point here, which is how much money City Gear might be able to bring in addition to that intellectual property Leighton talked about with Hibbett Sports. And City Gear, whose fiscal year ended in February, did report revenues of $190 million, which isn't bad in the growing but very, very crowded sneaker marketplace. Going forward, Hibbett does plan to invest in the City Gear brand. This isn't so much a pick up and just hold issue here, but Hibbett looks to act as a fuel source and ushering them cash to help grow their infrastructure and gain inventory. So one of the words that oftentimes gets thrown around with these type of deals is synergies. Well, in this case, City Gear should be able to tap into Hibbett Sports' distribution network, which is much, much larger than City Gear's still burgeoning distribution network. And one last thing that stands out to us is the margin improvement potential between these two companies combined. They will not only have increased confidence with what kind of assortments they're buying, but more buying power overall. Look, Hibbett already has made good progress with gross margin improvement during their last quarter, up 248 basis points. The main reason why they've been able to turn around their company from one of those that was struggling so mightily at the beginning of 2016 on into 2017, that's kind of turned around a little bit so far in 2018. Order quantities for the two companies combined are sure to rise in a number of categories, and this leverages their ability to profit and maybe hit some of those price breaks with the suppliers without having to lower prices in this inflationary environment. We talk so much about price competition, particularly when it comes to sporting goods because of those e-commerce players, and this may give Hibbett a chance to build on those margins without cutting the cost that they're charging the consumer. And if this is successful, the larger business stands to turn EPS positive or earnings per share positive in the coming quarters as the transaction is scheduled to close in about 4 to 5 weeks. Fairly quick schedule on this, pending, of course, all normal contingencies. Nothing is final until that final signature is released. Hibbett's next earnings call, by the way, for their fiscal third quarter will be released on November 27th. That'll be released with a little bit more of an eye towards this integration program, and we expect to hear more from Hibbett's leadership about their plans for City Gear going forward during this earnings call, and we'll update as necessary. Now, it just wouldn't be a retail-focused podcast during earnings season if we didn't discuss another retail REIT's earnings call. And so far, this episode has checked off a number of boxes for Leighton. He loves athletic retail, loves warehouse club retail, and now we're getting into retail real estate. So we're 3 for 3 as far as Leighton is concerned in his specialty areas. This week, our focus is on Retail Properties of America, who not only released earnings this Tuesday, but also released their annual property update earlier this fall. Now, the earnings call gives us a bit of an opportunity to wrap that annual property update along with their financial issues together into one story. Retail Properties of America, to give you an idea, is significantly smaller than the last two REITs we've covered. However, they are still in reinvestment mode, just like Agree Realty and the likes of CBL and company. Retail Properties of America was incorporated back in 2003, so a little bit more of a recent retail REIT. They're headquartered in Oak Brook, Illinois. At the end of their latest reporting period, which was their fiscal third quarter, they owned and operated 105 properties, covering 19.5 million square feet of space. This is actually down over the last few years due to some timely divestments, some good divestments, or divestments we feel are good for the company. We've covered them once on the podcast, but it's been over a year since we discussed them. And on that particular podcast, we talked about their desire to remain in the upper echelon in the shopping center space, owning open air centers that currently are thriving on their mixed use capability. One of the reasons why you're seeing those divestments as they attempt to maintain those open air centers and that upper echelon in that space. Properties are somewhat diverse geographically, although they do tend a little bit towards the Midwest. And looking at their plat maps, a depiction of the amount of land that their properties take up, many of their shopping centers act as kind of a town square, so to speak, with common areas for lounging and eating and walking. Essentially, and a lot of people are familiar with this concept in retail, but those town centers are beginning to grow in popularity compared to the indoor malls, something that we've covered vastly in the past on the Retail Focus podcast. Not necessarily a replacement for the indoor malls, but we're seeing them come in vogue in a number of different markets. That sets the table now for us to talk about this particular earnings report.
Looking to see how they're performing and how this concept of open-air shopping centers is working for this particular REIT, we look at their results, their third quarter results, as Trent mentioned, ticker RPAI. They turned in the results on Tuesday of this week, bringing in a disappointing 6 cents per share. Really doesn't tell the whole story, though. Missing estimates by a rather wide margin of 19 cents. So that's a massive disappointment there. They did bring in around 25 cents per share last year, so falling versus analyst estimates and falling year over year. Funds from operations, a measure that we talk about a lot with REITs, hit 26 cents per share, and management seemed actually pretty pleased with that particular number. Part of that number, you have to look at their debt and how much they're paying in terms of interest. Well, they are paying a lot of that debt back and more aggressively before it matures. You look at share buybacks too. They've been buying a lot back in shares, millions of dollars, in fact, and we'll get into that number in just a little bit. But they paid off higher interest mortgages, mortgages that averaged around 6%, leaving the remaining mortgage balances at an average interest rate of around 4.65%. If we look back at Agree Realty Holdings, their average debt was around 4%, 4.2%. So that's pretty good, especially in this environment where you're seeing a lot of rates go up, especially in the mortgage industry. In fact, I was just looking for a single family home, a 30-year conventional mortgage. It's around 4.85% right now for that conventional 30-year loan. That's a very, very high rate. Compare that to 2-3 years ago. But it's affecting commercial loans just the same. Those rates are going up as well. They now have a company low net debt to EBITDA ratio of 5.1 times as they continue to restructure their debt to more favorable terms. And on the revenue front, on the other hand, it came in a tad higher than Wall Street estimations. You see that rents and fees totaled $119 million, down 8.7% thanks to those divestments, but same store NOI up 3.8% to rent increases. So a lot of that is attributable to companies sort of re-upping or taking options that have higher rate increases. And you see year-to-date, NOI is up 2.1%. So net operating income, yet another measure that a lot of people in commercial real estate focus on. And CEO Steve Grimes told analysts on the call, for which there were six, by the way, from major banks, that they had to be short in their remarks for the Halloween preparations, so we thought that was a little odd. And considering that Halloween is much less important than commercial real estate for us anyway, we were sad to see that they didn't talk too extensively about their business. But Grimes did speak of the aggressive redevelopment that is happening in their portfolio. Again, they only have around 100 properties left, over 150 at one point in time. They are now positioned to have long-term growth, he thinks, because of that reinvestment. Some of these shopping centers aren't even that old, but they keep funneling money into these projects to make them more relevant for the areas in which they do business. They want to be seen as the prominent shopping centers for these cities and metropolitan areas. He sees the future in the U.S. as one that has continued wage growth and low unemployment figures, which leads to a less frugal customer. He sees that baby boomers are going to be retiring at a higher rate, and millennials are going to be spending at record levels. The line of thought, of course, being, while pretty optimistic, leads management to believe that they have a large upside in the future with the ability to raise rents on their tenants because more people, in theory, are going to be in these stores buying more items. This latest quarter saw 170 basis point improvement in base rents, so this is sort of taking on that trend. Most of these rate increases, by the way, were contractual. So like I had mentioned earlier, exercised options, not necessarily from new tenants where they're able to charge a higher rate than the previous tenant that has left the space vacant. Total occupancy rate hit 89.4%, and total leased area was around 90.6%. You see the gap in these two numbers really representing those retailers that have either left prematurely before their lease is up, or haven't yet moved into the space. So they recently signed a lease, but have yet to fully move in.
Now, that number is below some of the outstanding figures we've seen from other REITs that have reported occupancy rates between 97 and 99%, including Agree Realty, which we talked about last week. To put their 90% occupancy into context, we look at available data from the rest of the U.S., and it looks like first quarter retail occupancy, so not the most recent quarter, but the most recent quarter we have good data for, it's about 89 to 90%. That puts this particular number right around the national average, so not spectacular, but not terrible either. Some studies show a potential drop between now and the first quarter of 2020, suggesting a potential national retail occupancy rate of around 88.3% in 1.5 years. That's something we don't like to see, and I don't know that we even completely agree with that number, but it's still not indicative of a brick and mortar apocalypse like what we were hearing about last year. Still somewhat worrisome for a REIT here that boasts 4 million square feet, or at least boasts of 4 million square feet of expansion possibilities in their current holdings. Because while you can talk about the expansion possibilities in your current holdings, there's no need to expand if you can't fill your existing vacancies. So good in that they still have room to grow. Maybe not such a good thing in that they cannot fill their current shopping centers to that same 97 to 99% rate. Areas of redevelopment that they're looking towards include the DC and Baltimore area. Many developers are betting on Amazon's HQ2 to be in that DC area. Obviously, the workforce would mean the population would rise, but that also the types of jobs that Amazon would be hiring for are going to be higher paying, thus the reason you're going to bring in that higher retail. And while the cost of living is higher in DC than it was a decade ago, they'll ultimately need newer mixed-use centers to spend downtime if this is the case. Now, Grimes also, back to that earnings call, spoke of Sears, even reminiscing on some of the old Sears catalogs, kind of went on a tangent there, despite not talking that much about Halloween preparations and that type of thing. But Grimes mentioned that he viewed bankruptcy as inevitable, as we've heard from several other REITs, and can be happy for the entire commercial real estate industry now that everyone has more clarity and in some cases a little bit of closure on the retailer. We recently talked about how excited some REITs are about redeveloping the spaces that have seen Sears pay below market rents for far too long now. So in a way, the bankruptcy and these newly vacant stores may actually help certain people in the commercial real estate industry. Now, Grimes mentioned that it likely won't help them because they don't have direct exposure to Sears or Kmart, meaning that the additional 150 closures in the coming months between the two banners will not be affecting their top line. What is perhaps most interesting and something we've actually never discussed to this point on the podcast is how their property management teams look at indirect exposure to Sears and Kmart exiting spaces. The idea here being that property owners should be concerned about what happens to the vacant properties once they become redeveloped or released, and whether or not those future tenants have an effect on their current tenant base in terms of competition. So they're looking at competition. One thing we did mention a couple of weeks ago is the potential for future traffic flow from basically better or more traffic producing retailers than Sears or Kmart. We know Sears and Kmart aren't exactly going to produce a ton of traffic, but the concern here is that you could potentially drive down traffic to the shopping centers with a non-Sears or Kmart tenant, or they could entice current tenants to maybe move on over. So let's say REIT A has a holding that has Kmart or Sears. That's Kmart or Sears closes. REIT B has a nearby store that has, let's say for sake of argument, a JCPenney. That JCPenney moves over to that former Sears. Well, obviously that's going to cost REIT B there. So there is a little bit of a trickle-down effect that they're looking at. But according to the folks at Retail Properties of America, they are worried about neither based on where their over 100 properties are currently located. They don't even feel like they have indirect exposure to Sears and Kmart at this point.
They mentioned that Mattress Firm will be only closing one location that's in their portfolio, with them keeping a close eye on potential closings in 2019. And that's something we had talked about when we did discuss Mattress Firm closing a number of stores, around 500 in the next few months, on a previous podcast episode. And we noted that Mattress Firm is leaving the door open to close more locations if they can't renegotiate some leases that they already have with these types of shopping centers and these types of landlords. They did have a mention of a few Toys R Us locations that they had been hurt by, but 1 to 3 they think will be able to sign leases in the fourth quarter. So that's some good news there on that front. A lot of vacant retail space in the landscape, but those Toys R Us locations, Trent, as we noted with that bankruptcy filing, they've been swiped up very fast thanks to Ollie's Bargain Outlet and a number of other up-and-coming retailers, particularly in the off-price segment. Many of their recent openings at this particular REIT have to do with the fitness space, something that we've talked about a lot with Planet Fitness coming into these old shopping centers that were once anchored by a supermarket or something similar, but opening up yoga studios and one Peloton location did they in this last quarter. And as far as conventional stores we talk about on the podcast, so we've talked about these recent openings in the fitness space, Trader Joe's and the Container Store have signed new leases with the company. They're very thrilled about this Trader Joe's location. Anytime you have a grocery anchor, that tends to bring in traffic for all of the other adjacent retailers. The latter, by the way, taking over a Golfsmith store. Golfsmith, another retailer that had a lot of square footage and a lot of people scratching their heads wondering who is going to take over that space. But the Container Store has actually been doing better than we thought they would be, especially over the past 18 months or so. They are looking forward to forward-thinking retailers, put forward-thinking in quotation marks, as they look to retail partners to inhabit their properties that are in the fitness space or retailers that are up and coming, really offering something that is differentiated for the customers that traffic the area. But their third quarter saw them sign around 1 million square feet of leases in total. Just to sum it up, that's around 5% of their gross lease area now. In total, they have signed 142 deals at the end of the third quarter. And while they are growing, like we said, a lot of their capital has been funneled into share buybacks. I told you I would mention this, and I am here now telling you that 65% of their invested capital was in share repurchases. So they were confident that around the $11 or $12 mark for their shares, that was a buying opportunity for them. They feel as though the share price right now is a little undervalued versus what the market is expecting for the company. Their growth isn't what you would consider conventional, where they're not necessarily focused on extending immediately their total gross lease area, but focused rather on making current leasable area as valuable as possible. That really ties in to the redevelopment concept, where you're taking these Class B shopping centers, perhaps, and making them Class A plus. And they are an excellent manager and stewards of their properties, and they've really been proving out what they can do as far as being able to squeeze out lease rate hikes because of the quality of their shopping centers and because of that increased traffic that they're seeing. They're looking to divest some old locations, yet again, that they feel will not be great prospects for this mixed-use development. They are looking to acquire land, though, on those shopping centers that are seeing success, those current centers that have a better fit for those localized mixed-use voids in densely populated areas around the country. Shares ended on Friday around $11.87, giving away modest gains seen after earnings on Tuesday. They recently declared a 16-cent dividend, a quarterly dividend, based on the current share price. That is around a 5.3% yield, so not bad when you compare to their other REITs out there that are competing in this similar space around 4.5%, 4%, we're seeing. According to Zacks Investment Research, the company's average price target, though, from the analysts that they surveyed, is around $15. So there is some upside, which gives credence to management's thoughts that buying up shares at $10 or $11, $12 even, is a good investment considering the one-year price target's $3 to $4 higher at the current times. And highs this year around $13, lows in the $10 range. Market cap right now for the company at that $11.87 mark, around $2.6 billion, a trailing price-to-earnings ratio of 14.
Well, since we're already 3 for 3 in this retail focus episode as far as things that Leighton likes to talk about, let's make it 4 for 4, as he can't let this retail focus episode go by without Lumber Liquidators earnings. Now, Lumber Liquidators has been through another rough year as stock market gains throughout the last half of 2017 have been completely wiped out to this point in 2018. Shares are down over 60% year to date. It's been a roller coaster ride, and that would be an understatement, a very steep roller coaster ride up and down. Now, Lumber Liquidators hasn't been doing horribly, but they've been growing at such a slow pace despite being in a bullish industry that it's causing concern for many analysts and people who like to look at this particular company. Revenue for this latest quarter, their fiscal third quarter, was up a modest 5.2% to $270 million. This missed average estimates by about 4%. Same-store sales were up 2.1%. And although we would ordinarily say that this is good, this looks pretty poor in the face of what their competitors are putting up, and with inflation coming in over 2%. Comparable store growth reflected a 5.5% increase in average sale. This is driven by both higher attachment of installation to the sale and an increased mix of pro customers that, of course, have larger bulk purchases. But this was all offset partially by a 3.4% decrease in the number of transactions. The slowing in transactions is not a welcome sign, especially for a company that has poured so much into marketing and has taken a margin hit because of that. Lighter August and September traffic than anticipated, and they noted that poor weather and hurricane activity along the East Coast had a pretty much neutral impact on the business. Not a ton more sales they're seeing yet due to rebuilding, due to the hurricanes, but also not major lapses in traffic either. Mild effects basically working to counteract one another. We may see effects increase as people begin to do some rebuilding work on their homes that were largely affected by the hurricane. Now, the company did lower full-year comp guidance and operating income, adjusted earnings of 27 cents per share. This beat Zacks consensus estimates of 18 cents per share. This compares to just 12 cents last year. Now, net income came in at $5.92 million, representing a meager net margin of 2.2%, still far better than the over $18 million loss that was clocked last year, and still better net margins than what they see for the full year, which they predict will be between 1.8% and 2%. Now, gross margins increased 120 basis points to 37.2%, still far below the original long-term thesis for most investors. Now, this was a fairly good increase for us. However, when adjusted for sales, a non-GAAP measure, gross margins were only 36.2%. They had more SKUs on their promotional pricing programs, which hurt their ability to squeeze out profits. Once again, we kind of referenced how the advertising in the past had cut out profits there. Well, in this circumstance, it's that promotional pricing that's doing the trick to kind of whittle away at what those gross margins would otherwise be expected to be.
One last piece on the expense side of the equation. Selling, general, and administrative expenses did improve 100 basis points. Lesser legal expenses helped here, particularly with what they claimed was MDL expenses, which are multi-district litigation expenses that are often bundled together for civil suits that get ushered through as one single court case. So oftentimes this happens in large environmental suits to simplify the process in complex cases, because you get all of these different lawsuits from different areas, but they're pretty much similar in what they're trying to allege. So the company has been able to actually mitigate those costs through this latest year, in fact. And this is one thing that we've been keeping a close eye on is when will these civil suits and environmental suits go away? Well, they are paying a lot less now, and that is really showing up in that SG&A number. The other notable item for us was occupancy costs. The last notable item here is they paid $1 million more overall, but they do have more stores available, more units total that they have to pay rents for. So they are seeing an increase in rents, but I think that increase is fairly slight compared to the overall base that they now have to try to leverage against. Overall, they feel as though they can really deleverage their overall selling, general, and administrative costs as they expand their business out. And on the call, CEO Dennis Knowles was steering those in the call in the direction of their long-term view. He was reminding analysts that this is a multi-year transformation with a multitude of initiatives yet to be fully executed on. And while it may seem at this point like this is the longest rebound ever for a retailer, there are some relatively new senior executive positions and senior executives with the company. And you see these roles, such as Chief Customer Experience Officer, really focused on what's trending and what the customers want. So I think this is very important for them, and important that CEO Dennis Knowles points this out to the analysts and those like us listening on the call to tell them, like, you know what? We've had some different strategies in place, but some of the more recent initiatives have just now taken hold. So give it 1, 2, 3 more years down the line to really see the fruits of our labor. And it seems as though advertising experiments may have hurt them as well in this quarter, but this is something they're going to continue to rely upon. They spoke of momentum in terms of advertising and store traffic in July that really gave them confidence and what they felt like room to apply different marketing strategies in August and September. However, in my opinion, if something was already working, if you're gaining momentum through the month of July, why would you change it up when you're riding a hot streak in sales? In their press release, they noted a negative $700,000 difference in advertising expenses, meaning they paid $700,000 less. And a lot of this was because digital ads are less, in some cases, than national ad campaigns. Regardless of short-term learning curves, they said they do want to stay away from those big national ad campaigns now and do more with targeted digital avenues. And I think this is smart for the company, and there is going to be a learning curve. And so while I think it's a negative that maybe they did experiment a little too soon or a little too aggressively in the months of August and September, I think that overall what they're doing, straying away from those newspaper listings and the sports advertising, it's going to be a positive for them. And I mentioned sports advertising. It's unclear as to whether or not we're going to see less Lumber Liquidators billboards in the MLB next year as a result of this said statement. But one thing they have done is identify different opportunities, different ways to reach the customer on the digital landscape, realizing that Lumber Liquidators must be noticed online when customers are comparing different flooring products. And this is very important, Trent. I love the fact that they actually backed this up with their own in-house research and some of the anecdotal stories that they had there at the executive team. Their research tells them that 80% of their customers actually look online at projects first and price out different items before coming into the store to make that purchase, before opening their wallets. And that's extremely important because if you think from the promotional aspect, from the advertising aspect, you want to be listed first on a Google search or at least on the first page. Having recently visited their mobile site, we can say that it has improved a lot. So when they are having customers getting funneled to their website, it is really a much better website than it was, say, 2, 3 years ago. But they do have a long way to go, in our opinion. And something to be desired in general is that the general feel, in our opinion, the landing page, it's a little bit too promotional. A lot of things happening on that landing page. It really doesn't tell the story of what you do. And honestly, they could actually take some merchandising cues from some other retailers that do a great job of promoting their products first rather than just telling them that there's a sale going on. Sale on what? Show us what you sell. Show us what you're good at in terms of service. They are working to use better data and better coordinate price with promotion for better margins on popular and trending products. And this is something we had seen a couple of years ago with their bamboo product, really trying to push that and sell through that particular item. Localized marketing is going to be a focal point for them, and this speaks to digital a lot because a lot of people now have localized data. What is hot locally? What is going to sell through? And what should we be promoting in one city versus another that maybe is 2,000 miles away? Something we have yet to hear from them in the past earnings calls.
The larger strategy here is to have better brand recognition, and then once customers hit the stores, give them quality one-on-one expert service. Now, that's the idea anyway. They alluded to having more technology to complement the human interaction, and by 2022, they want 500 stores throughout the U.S., meaning they want to open another 100 or so stores in the coming year. Now, this year, they're on track to have opened 22 stores, missing the top end of their expected range of 25, but they do expect store openings to slightly scale up as you get closer to 2022. Now, quickly, let's discuss tariffs, like with the tile shop earnings that we covered recently. The Lumber Liquidators, subject now to Chinese tariffs, as of September 24th, they're having to pay a 10% tax on Chinese imports. And, you know, it could be figured that since the 60 Minutes special on their floorings formaldehyde content, we would assume that Lumber Liquidators reduced their reliance on Chinese manufacturers. However, years later, still makes up 45% of their products. That is still significant risk exposure, not only in terms of tariffs, but also in terms of environmental impacts. Because they expect these tariffs to go to 25% by January 1st, they're hard at work trying to renegotiate terms and open up dialogue with other vendors, perhaps some they've used in the past. And according to management, all options are on the table as far as sourcing, and every purchase decision has to take into account cost management, which is an integral piece, of course, in any supply chain operation. Now, one thing we should mention that might help them find additional suppliers, they do have a new head of global sourcing with connections to different markets outside of just Asia, which is great timing for that change if they can truly capitalize on some of that networking. Now, shares for Lumber Liquidators fell initially, but then rebounded to pre-trading levels, hanging around that $12 mark all week, an almost $360 million market cap, which would give them an almost normal sounding forward price to earnings ratio of 17. This would assume legal expenses stay in check and that growth stays modestly positive as the company is forecasting.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
Well, we've reached the final segment of the Retail Focus podcast, a segment we call Looking Ahead, where each Leighton and I pick a story that we're keeping an eye on for the next week, month, or year, and we start with Leighton.
My looking ahead has to do with Toys R Us, and no, they are not opening a brick-and-mortar store, but they are still alive in some form or fashion. Toys R Us had liquidated pretty much everything during their bankruptcy via several different auctions, except for the majority of their intellectual property, property that is still seen by some, by most, in fact, in the retail industry, as very valuable. People had speculated about what they had planned to do with the brand, with some industry insiders saying that they would never work with the controlling interests now, because they had mismanaged the debt and really burdened the stores and needlessly caused the elimination of their stores as a consequence of mismanagement. And as a result, they just don't want to work with them. They don't trust them. And I think a lot of people feel like they were really brought down by the poor management over the past few years at Toys R Us. But fast forward to now, regardless of all of what's happened in the recent past, we now look and see that Kroger, the nation's largest grocer, has signed on to have 600 pop-up shops that are going to be from the previous or current controlling interest in Toys R Us. Some have been actually spotted in early as October, October 3rd, in fact, in Kroger-owned Fred Meyer stores. But now it is official with a press release. They will be branded as Jeffrey's Toy Box, a play off of the famous giraffe there at Toys R Us. The New York Post was actually first to report this as Toy Insiders not wanting much to do with the owners from the recently formed Jeffrey LLC And this is relevant because most of the toys sold at these Kroger locations are going to be private label. And this is interesting because you think of Toys R Us having every toy from Hasbro and Mattel selections to pretty much everything. This was a hot spot for a lot of vendors, new toy vendors to get in. But most of these toys will actually be private label, around 20 different private label brands, in fact. And the price point is a little bit interesting to me, at least. It's going to be around $20 to $50. Pretty high price when you're looking at impulse buys and toys. You think $5, $10, $15, not $20 to $50. So these pop-up shops are going to be a little bit interesting. Curious to see how this goes. And that pretty much is why this is my looking ahead story. How does this benefit Kroger in terms of traffic? People are already going to Kroger. They're not necessarily going for their toys. How much does this boost the top line sales? Floor space is valuable, especially for Kroger, as they've been experimenting with general merchandise. They've been in the general merchandise arena now for some time, first with home goods, then apparel, and now a broadened toy selection thanks to these pop-up shops. And the second question I have, beyond what kind of traffic or what's going to happen in terms of the sales per square foot for the Kroger location, the second question is how this is going to adjust for the long term. How long is this partnership going to be? It's unclear how the partnership will actually be structured financially. So my main question is it just going to be for the holidays? Is it just going to be for the next 6 months? And the notable upside in all of this, by the way, Trent, in my opinion, is that we are saving Jeffrey, the toy-loving giraffe that everybody loves. And honestly, this is a story that has some positivity surrounding it because this is a extension of the Toys R Us brand, in fact, keeping it alive, even if it is in a grocery store in Kroger outlets throughout the country.
I'll keep my looking ahead story short and sweet. You know, there are two large shopping centers in North America that I really view as key shopping centers in terms of how we view retail in the United States. One of them is the Mall of America. The other is the West Edmonton Mall up in Alberta. I want to talk about the Mall of America here as details were released by the city of Bloomington, Minnesota this week, which is where, of course, the Mall of America is located, that details have tentatively at least been reached on opening up a water park, perhaps what could be the continent's largest indoor water park, next to the Mall of America. Now, the city and Triple Five both, and Triple Five, by the way, is the mall's ownership group, have agreed upon the fact that a nonprofit should run the water park after the water park is opening. The water park, by the way, would be 250,000 square feet, could cost up to $250 million. Construction projected to start in late 2019. Water park could be open by fall of 2021. Now, a few different reasons I'm looking ahead to this story. First is, will the water park be constructed on time? The second part of it is this really the right option to keep the Mall of America pertinent in the eyes of American retailers long term? Now, there are a lot of analysts and onlookers that say that, you know, shopping malls may be going a little bit downhill overall, and they speculate that because we've seen a lot of B through D class malls really struggle in the United States. So far, though, the Mall of America hasn't seen a significant drop, and they continue to remain technologically prudent as far as developing for the next 5 to 10 years. But there are people that doubt the long-term viability of the Mall of America. So is this the proper route to keep the Mall of America relevant above and beyond just the retail influence that it has? And then what traffic will this water park bring, if any, to the Mall of America when it opens, should it open, in 2021? Well, that'll do it for us here on the Retail Focus Podcast. For Leighton, I'm Trent. I'll say so long until next week, where we'll have another set of retail news and information for you 7 days from now.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.